Chapter 3. Again, Bruce glanced at his wristwatch. It was still 20 minutes before the curfew ended at 0600 hours. Until then, he must fret away the time watching Wally Hendry finishing his breakfast. This was a spectacle without much appeal, for Hendry was a methodical but untidy eater. "Why don't you keep your mouth closed?" snapped Bruce irritably, unable to stand it any longer. "Do I ask you your business?" Hendry looked up from his plate. His jowls were covered with a ginger stubble of beard, and his eyes were inflamed and puffy from the previous evening's debauchery. Bruce looked away from him and checked his watch again. The suicidal temptation to ignore the curfew and set off immediately for the railway station was very strong. It required an effort to resist it. The least he could expect if he followed that course was an arrest by one of the patrols, and a delay of 12 hours while he cleared himself. The worst would be a shooting incident. He poured himself another cup of coffee and sipped it slowly. "Impatience has always been one of my weaknesses," he reflected. "Nearly every mistake I have ever made stems from that cause. But I have improved a little over the years. At 20 I wanted to live my whole life in a week. Now I'll settle for a year." He finished his coffee and checked the time again. 6:05. He could risk it now. It would take almost that long to get out to the truck. "If you are ready, gentlemen." He pushed back his chair and picked up his pack, slung it over his shoulder and led the way out. Ruffy was waiting for them, sitting on a pile of stores in one of the corrugated iron goods sheds. His men squatted round a dozen small fires on the concrete floor, cooking breakfast. "Where's the train?" "That's a good question, boss," Ruffy congratulated him, and Bruce groaned. "It should have been here long ago," Bruce protested, and Ruffy shrugged. "Should have been is a lot different from is. God damn it, we've still got to load up. We'll be lucky if we get away before noon," snapped Bruce. "I'll go up to the station master." "You better take him a present, boss. We've still got a case left." "No, hell," Bruce growled. "Come with me, Mike." With Mike beside him, they crossed the tracks to the main platform and clambered up onto it. At the far end, a group of railway officials stood chatting, and Bruce fell upon them furiously. 2 hours later, Bruce stood beside the coloured engine driver on the footplate, and they puffed slowly down towards the goods yard. The driver was a roly-poly little man with a skin too dark for mere sunburn, and a set of teeth with bright red plastic gums. "Monsieur, you do not wish to proceed to Port Reprieve?" he asked anxiously. "Yes." "There is no way of telling the condition of the permanent way. No traffic has used it these last 4 months." "I know. You'll have to proceed with caution." "There is a United Nations barrier across the lines near the old aerodrome," protested the man. "We have a pass," Bruce smiled to soothe him. His bad temper was abating now that he had his transport. "Stop next to the first shed." With a hiss of steam brakes, the train pulled up beside the concrete platform, and Bruce jumped down. "All right, Ruffy," he shouted. "Let's get cracking." Bruce had placed the 3 steel-sided open trucks in the van, for they were the easiest to defend. From behind the breast-high sides, the Bren guns could sweep ahead and on both flanks. Then followed the 2 passenger coaches, to be used as storerooms and officers' quarters. Also, for the accommodation of the refugees on the return journey. Finally, the locomotive in the rear, where it would be least vulnerable, and would not spew smoke and soot back over the train. The stores were loaded into 4 of the compartments, the windows shuttered and the doors locked. Then Bruce set about laying out his defences. In a low circle of sandbags on the roof of the leading coach, he sighted one of the Brens, and made this his own post. From here he could look down over the open trucks, back at the locomotive, and also command an excellent view of the surrounding country. The other Brens he placed in the leading truck, and put Hendry in command there. He had obtained from the Major at Ordnance 3 of the new walkie-talkie sets. One he gave to the engine driver, another to Hendry up front, and the 3rd he retained in his emplacement, and his system of communication was satisfactory. It was almost 12 o'clock before these preparations were complete, and Bruce turned to Ruffy, who sat on the sandbags beside him.
All set? All set, boss.
How many missing? Bruce had learned from experience never to expect his entire command to be in any one place at any one time.
8, boss.
That's 3 more than yesterday. Leaves us only 52 men. Do you think they've taken off into the bush also? 5 of his men had deserted with their weapons on the day of the ceasefire. Obviously, they had gone out into the bush to join one of the bands of Shufter that were already playing havoc along the main roads, ambushing all unprotected traffic, beating up lucky travellers, and murdering those less fortunate, raping when they had the opportunity, and generally enjoying themselves.
No, boss, I don't think so.
Those 3 are good boys. They'll be down in the Cité Indigène, having themselves some fun. Guess they just forgot the time. Ruffy shook his head. Take us about 30 minutes to find them. All we do is go down and visit all the Nock shops. You want to try?
No, we haven't time to mess around if we're going to make M'Sapa Junction before dark. We'll pick them up again when we get back.
Was there ever an army since the Boer War that treated desertion so lightly? Bruce wondered. He turned to the radio set beside him and depressed the transmit button.
Driver?
Oui, monsieur.
Proceed very slowly until we approach the United Nations barrier. Stop well this side of it.
Oui, monsieur.
They rolled out of the goods yard, clicking over the points, leaving the industrial quarter on their right, with the Katangese guard posts on the Avenue de Cimetière intersection. Out through the suburbs until ahead of them, Bruce saw the UN positions, and he felt the first stirring of anxiety. The pass he carried in the breast pocket of his jacket was signed by General Ree Singh, but before in this war the orders of an Indian general had not been passed by a Sudanese captain to an Irish sergeant. The reception that awaited them could be exciting.
I hope they know about us. Mike Haig lit his cigarette with a show of nonchalance, but he peered over it anxiously at the piles of fresh earth on either side of the tracks that marked the position of the emplacements.
These boys have got bazookas, and they're Irish Arabs, muttered Ruffy. I reckon that's the maddest kind of Arab there is, Irish. How would you like a bazooka bomb up the throat, boss?
No thanks, Ruffy, Bruce declined, and pressed the button of the radio.
Hendry.
In the leading truck, Wally Hendry picked up his set, and holding it against his chest, looked back at Bruce.
Curry?
Tell your gunners to stand away from the Brens, and the rest of them to lay down their rifles.
Right.
Bruce watched him relaying the order, pushing them back, moving among the gendarmes who crowded the forward trucks. Bruce could sense the air of tension that had fallen over the whole train, watched as his gendarmes reluctantly laid down their weapons and stood empty-handed, staring sullenly ahead at the UN barrier.
Driver, Bruce spoke again into the radio, slow down. Stop 50 meters this side of the barrier. But if there's any shooting, open the throttle and take us straight through.
Oui, monsieur.
Ahead of them there was no sign of a reception committee, only the hostile barrier of poles and petrol drums across the line. Bruce stood upon the roof and lifted his arms above his head in a gesture of neutrality. It was a mistake. The movement charged the passive mood of the gendarmes in the trucks below him. One of them lifted his arms also, but his fists were clenched.
UN merde, he shouted, and immediately the cry was taken up. UN merde! UN merde! They chanted the war cry, laughing at first, but then no longer laughing, their voices rising sharply.
Shut up, damn you! Bruce roared, and swung his open hand against the head of the gendarme beside him. But the man hardly noticed it. His eyes were glazing with the infectious hysteria to which the African is so susceptible. He had snatched up his rifle and was holding it across his chest. Already his body was beginning to jerk convulsively as he chanted. Bruce hooked his fingers under the rim of the man's steel helmet and yanked it forward over his eyes so that the back of his neck was exposed. He chopped him with a judo blow, and the gendarme slumped forward over the sandbags, his rifle slipping from his hands. Bruce looked up desperately. In the trucks below him the hysteria was spreading.
Stop them! Hendry! De Sourier! Stop them, for God's sake! but his voice was lost in the chanting. A gendarme snatched up his rifle from where it lay at his feet. Bruce saw him elbow his way towards the side of the truck to begin firing. He was working the slide to lever around into the breech. "Mwembe!" Bruce shouted the gendarme's name, but his voice could not penetrate the uproar. In 2 seconds, the whole situation would dissolve into a pandemonium of tracer and bazooka fire. Poised on the forward edge of the roof, Bruce checked for an instant to judge the distance, and then he jumped. He landed squarely on the gendarme's shoulders, his weight throwing the man forward so his face hit the steel edge of the truck, and they went down together onto the floor. The gendarme's finger was resting on the trigger, and the rifle fired as it spun from his hands. A complete hush followed the roar of the rifle, and in it Bruce scrambled to his feet, drawing his pistol from the canvas holster on his hip. "All right," he panted, menacing the men around him. "Come on, give me a chance to use this." He picked out one of his sergeants and held his eyes. "You, I'm waiting for you. Start shooting." At the sight of the revolver, the man relaxed slowly, and the madness faded from his face. He dropped his eyes and shuffled awkwardly. Bruce glanced up at Ruffy and Haig on the roof and raised his voice. "Watch them. Shoot the first one who starts it again." "Okay, boss." Ruffy thrust forward the automatic rifle in his hands. "Who's it going to be?" he asked cheerfully, looking down at them. But the mood had changed. Their attitudes of defiance gave way to sheepish embarrassment, and a small buzz of conversation filled the silence. "Mike," Bruce yelled, urgent again, "call the driver. He's trying to take us through." The noise of their passage had risen, the driver accelerating at the sound of the shot, and now they were racing down towards the UN barrier. Mike Haig grabbed the set, shouted an order into it, and immediately the brakes swooshed and the train jolted to a halt, not 100 yards short of the barrier. Slowly, Bruce clambered back onto the roof of the coach. "Close?" asked Mike. "My God," Bruce shook his head and lit a cigarette with slightly unsteady hands. "Another 50 yards. Then he turned and stared coldly down at his gendarmes. "Can I? Next time you try to commit suicide, don't take me with you." The gendarme he had knocked down was now sitting up, fingering the ugly black swelling above his eye. "My friend," Bruce turned on him, "later I will have something for your further discomfort." Then to the other man in the emplacement beside him who was massaging his neck, "And for you also. Take their names, Sergeant Major." "Sir," growled Ruffy. "Mike." Bruce's voice changed, soft again. "I'm going ahead to toss the blarney with our friends behind the bazookas. When I give you the signal, bring the train through." "You don't want me to come with you?" asked Mike. "No, stay here." Bruce picked up his rifle, slung it over his shoulder, dropped down the ladder onto the path beside the tracks, and walked forward with the gravel crunching beneath his boots. An auspicious beginning to the expedition, he decided grimly. Tragedy averted by the wink of an eye before they had even passed the outskirts of the city. At least the Mickeys hadn't added a few bazooka bombs to the altercation. Bruce peered ahead and could make out the shape of helmets behind the earthworks. Without the breeze of the train's passage, it was hot again, and Bruce felt himself starting to sweat. "Stay where you are, mister," a deep brogue from the emplacement nearest the tracks. Bruce stopped, standing on the wooden cross ties in the sun. Now he could see the faces of the men beneath the helmets, unfriendly, not smiling. "What was the shooting for?" the voice questioned. "We had an accident." "Don't have any more, or we might have one also." "I'd not be wanting that, Paddy." Bruce smiled thinly, and the Irishman's voice had an edge to it as he went on. "What's your mission?" "I have a pass. Do you want to see it?" Bruce took the folded sheet of paper from his breast pocket. "What's your mission?" repeated the Irishman. "Proceed to Port Reprieve and relieve the town." "We know about you," the Irishman nodded. "Let me see the pass." Bruce left the tracks, climbed the earth wall, and handed the pink slip to the Irishman. He wore the three pips of a captain, and he glanced briefly at the pass before speaking to the man beside him. "Very well, Sergeant. You can be clearing the barrier now."
"I'll call the train through?" Bruce asked, and the captain nodded again.
"But make sure there are no more accidents. We don't like hired killers."
"Sure, and begorra now, Paddy. It's not your war you're a-fighting either," snapped Bruce, and abruptly turned his back on the man, jumped down onto the tracks and waved to Mike Haig on the roof of the coach. The Irish sergeant and his party had cleared the tracks, and while the train rumbled slowly down to him, Bruce struggled to control his irritation. The Irish captain's taunt had reached him. Hired killer. And, of course, that was what he was. Could a man sink any lower?
As the coach drew level with where he stood, Bruce caught the handrail and swung himself aboard, waved an ironical farewell to the Irish captain, and climbed up onto the roof.
"No trouble?" asked Mike.
"A bit of lip, delivered in music hall brogue," Bruce answered, "but nothing serious." He picked up the radio set.
"Driver?"
"Monsieur?"
"Do not forget my instructions."
"I will not exceed 40 kilometres the hour, and I shall at all times be prepared for an emergency stop."
"Good." Bruce switched off the set and sat down on the sandbags between Ruffy and Mike.
"Well," he thought, "here we go at last. 6 hours' run to Msapa Junction. That should be easy. And then, God knows, God alone knows."
The tracks curved, and Bruce looked back to see the last whitewashed buildings of Elizabethville disappear among the trees. They were out into the open savannah forest. Behind them, the black smoke from the loco rolled sideways into the trees. Beneath them, the cross ties clattered in strict rhythm, and ahead, the line ran arrow straight for miles, dwindling with perspective until it merged into the olive-green mass of the forest. Bruce lifted his eyes. Half the sky was clear and tropical blue, but in the north it was bruised with cloud, and beneath the cloud, grey rain drifted down to meet the earth. The sunlight, through the rain, spun a rainbow, and the cloud shadow moved across the land as slowly and as darkly as a herd of grazing buffalo. He loosened the chin strap of his helmet and laid his rifle on the roof beside him.
"You'd like a beer, boss?"
"Have you any?"
"Sure,"
Ruffy called to one of the gendarmes, and the man climbed down into the coach and came back with half a dozen bottles. Ruffy opened two with his teeth. Each time half the contents frothed out and splattered back along the wooden side of the coach.
"This beer's as wild as an angry woman," he grunted as he passed a bottle to Bruce.
"It's wet anyway." Bruce tasted it, warm and gassy and too sweet.
"Here's how," said Ruffy.
Bruce looked down into the open trucks at the gendarmes who were settling in for the journey. Apart from the gunners at the Brenz, they were lying or squatting in attitudes of complete relaxation, and most of them had stripped down to their underwear. One skinny little fellow was already asleep on his back, with his helmet as a pillow, and the tropical sun beating full into his face. Bruce finished his beer and threw the bottle overboard. Ruffy opened another and placed it in his hand without comment.
"Why are we going so slowly, boss?"
"I told the driver to keep the speed down. Give us a chance to stop if the tracks have been torn up."
"Yeah, them Balubas might have done that. They're mad Arabs, all of them."
The warm beer, drunk in the sun, was having a soothing effect on Bruce. He felt at peace now, withdrawn from the need to make decisions, to participate in the life around him.
"Listen to that train talk," said Ruffy,
and Bruce focused his hearing on the clickety-clack of the cross ties.
"Yes, I know.
You can make it say anything you want it to," agreed Bruce.
"And it can sing," Ruffy went on. "It's got real music in it, like this."
He inflated the great barrel of his chest, lifted his head, and let it come. His voice was deep, but with a resonance that caught the attention of the men in the open trucks below them. Those who had been sprawled in the amorphous shapes of sleep stirred and sat up. Another voice joined in humming the tune, hesitantly at first, then more confidently. Then others took it up.
The words were unimportant. It was the rhythm that they could not resist. They had sung together many times before, and like a well-trained choir, each voice found its place, the star performers leading, changing the pace, improvising, quickening until the original tune lost its identity and became one of the tribal chants. Bruce recognized it as a planting song. It was one of his favorites, and he sat drinking his lukewarm beer and letting the singing wash around him, build up into the chorus like storm waves, then fall back into a tenor solo before rising once more. And the train ran on through the sunlight, towards the rain clouds in the north. Presently, André came out of the coach below him and picked his way forward through the men in the trucks until he reached Hendry. The two of them stood together. André's face turned up towards the taller man, and deadly earnest as he talked. "Doll boy," Hendry had called him, and it was an accurate description of the effeminately pretty face with the big toffee eyes. The steel helmet he wore seemed too large for his shoulders to carry. "I wonder how old he is." Bruce watched him laugh suddenly, his face still turned upwards to Hendry. "Not much over 20, and I have never seen anything less like a hired killer." How the hell did anyone like De Surya get mixed up in this? His voice echoed the thought, and beside him, Mike answered. "He was working in Elizabethville when it started, and he couldn't return to Belgium. I don't know the reason, but I guess it was something personal. When it started, his firm closed down. I suppose this was the only employment he could find." "That Irishman, the one at the barrier, he called me a hired killer." Thinking of André's position in the scheme of things had turned Bruce's thoughts back to his own status. "I hadn't thought about it that way before, but I suppose he's right. That is what we are." Mike Haig was silent for a moment, but when he spoke, there was a stark quality in his voice. "Look at these hands." Involuntarily, Bruce glanced down at them, and for the first time noticed that they were narrow with long moulded fingers, possessed of a functional beauty, the hands of an artist. "Look at them," Mike repeated, flexing them slightly. "They were fashioned for a purpose. They were made to hold a scalpel. They were made to save life." Then he relaxed them and let them drop onto the rifle across his lap, the long, delicate fingers incongruous upon the blue metal. "But look what they hold now." Bruce stirred irritably. He had not wanted to provoke another bout of Mike Haig's soul-searching. Damn the old fool. Why must he always start this? He knew as well as anyone that in the mercenary army of Katanga there was a taboo upon the past. It did not exist. "Ruffy," Bruce snapped, "aren't you going to feed your boys?" "Right now, boss." Ruffy opened another beer and handed it to Bruce. "Hold that. It'll keep your mind off food while I rustle it up." He lumbered off along the roof of the coach, still singing. 3 years ago, it seems like all eternity, Mike went on as though Bruce had not interrupted. 3 years ago I was a surgeon, and now this. The desolation had spread to his eyes, and Bruce felt his pity for the man deep down where he kept it imprisoned with all his other emotions. "I was good. I was one of the best. Royal College, Harley Street, guys." Mike laughed without humour, with bitterness. "Can you imagine me being driven in my rolls to address the college on my advanced technique of cholecystectomy? What happened?" The question was out before he could stop it, and Bruce realised how near to the surface he had let his pity rise. "No, don't tell me. It's your business. I don't want to know." "But I'll tell you, Bruce, I want to. It helps somehow, talking about it." At first, thought Bruce, I wanted to talk also, to try and wash the pain away with words. Mike was silent for a few seconds. Below them the singing rose and fell, and the train ran on through the forest. "It had taken me 10 hard years to get there, but at last I had done it. A fine practice, doing the work I loved with skill, earning the rewards I deserved. A wife that any man would have been proud of, a lovely home, many friends. Too many friends, perhaps. For success breeds friends the way a dirty kitchen breeds cockroaches. Mike pulled out a handkerchief and dried the back of his neck where the wind could not reach. Those sort of friends mean parties, he went on. Parties, when you've worked all day and you're tired, when you need the lift that you can get so easily from a bottle. You don't know if you have the weakness for the stuff until it's too late, until you have a bottle in the drawer of your desk, until suddenly your practice isn't so good anymore. Mike twisted the handkerchief around his fingers as he ploughed doggedly on. Then you know it suddenly. You know it when your hands dance in the morning and all you want for breakfast is that. When you can't wait until lunchtime because you have to operate, and that's the only way you can keep your hands steady. But you know it finally and utterly, when the knife turns in your hand, and the artery starts to spurt, and you watch it, paralyzed. You watch it hosing red over your gown and forming pools on the theatre floor. Mike's voice dried up then, and he tapped a cigarette from his pack and lit it. His shoulders were hunched forward, and his eyes were full of the shadows of his guilt. Then he straightened up, and his voice was stronger. You must have read about it. I was headlines for a few days, all the papers. But my name wasn't Haig in those days. I got that name off a label on a bottle in a bar room. Gladys stayed with me, of course. She was that type. We came out to Africa. I had enough saved from the wreck for a down payment on a tobacco farm in the Centenary block outside Salisbury. Two good seasons, and I was off the bottle. Gladys was having our first baby. We had both wanted one so badly. It was all coming right again. Mike stuffed the handkerchief back in his pocket, and his voice lost its strength again, turning dry and husky. Then, one day, I took the truck into the village, and on the way home I stopped at the club. I had been there often before, but this time it was different. Instead of half an hour, I stayed there until they threw me out at closing time. And when I got back to the farm, I had a case of scotch on the seat beside me. Bruce wanted to stop him. He knew what was coming, and he didn't want to hear it. The first rain started that night, and the rivers came down in flood. The telephone lines were knocked out, and we were cut off. In the morning, Mike stopped again and turned to Bruce. I suppose it was the shock of seeing me like that again. But in the morning, Gladys went into labour. It was her first, and she wasn't so young anymore. She was still in labour the next day, but by then she was too weak to scream. I remember how peaceful it was without her screaming and pleading with me to help. You see, she knew I had all the instruments I needed. She begged me to help. I can remember that, her voice through the fog of whiskey. I think I hated her then. I think I remember hating her. It was all so confused, so mixed up with the screaming and the liquor. But at last she was quiet. I don't think I realized she was dead. I was simply glad she was quiet and I could have peace. He dropped his eyes from Bruce's face. I was too drunk to go to the funeral. Then I met a man in a barroom. I can't remember how long after it was. I can't even remember where. It must have been on the Copper Belt. He was recruiting for Tshombe's army, and I signed up. There didn't seem anything else to do. Neither of them spoke again until a gendarme brought food to them, hunks of brown bread spread with tinned butter and filled with bully beef and pickled onions. They ate in silence, listening to the singing, and Bruce said at last, "You needn't have told me." "I know." "Mike," Bruce paused. "Yes?" "I'm sorry, if that's any comfort." "It is," Mike said. "It helps to have... not to be completely alone. I like you, Bruce." He blurted out the last sentence, and Bruce recoiled as though Mike had spat in his face. "You fool," he rebuked himself savagely. "You were wide open then. You nearly let one of them in again." Remorselessly, he crushed down his sympathy, shocked at the effort it required. And when he picked up the radio, the gentleness had gone from his eyes. "Henry," he spoke into the set, "don't talk so much. I put you up front to watch the tracks." From the leading truck, Wally Hendry looked round and forked two fingers at Bruce in a casual obscenity, but he turned back and faced ahead. "You'd better go and take over from Hendry," Bruce told Mike. "Send him back here." Mike Haig stood up and looked down at Bruce. "What are you afraid of?" His voice softly puzzled. "I gave you an order, Haig."
"Yes."
"I'm on my way."